Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is World Form Zen Fighting Champion John Chung, and you're listening to the AMAA Legends and Pioneers Radio Blog Show with Professor Gary Lee and the Sport Karate Museum Archives, protecting the history, one warrior at a time. Enjoy.
Aloha, everyone. This is Professor Gary Lee with the Sport Karate Museum Archives, and we have a very, very special show for you tonight. We have the icons of sport karate, and I'm going to surprise you as we get more into the show. People wonder what makes things happen in the sport karate community, but it all started with a group of pioneers, and the pioneers that started sport karate in the 60s and carried it on and created it in the 70s, they changed everything. And it's because of them is the reason why we do it today. And it's going into the Olympics in 2020. And we can really thank a lot of these gentlemen that are going to be on here tonight. It's kind of, I was wondering how I was going to actually start the idea of talking about this gentleman. But, I'm going to open it like I always do, and then we're going to go right into talking to me how I feel about him personally, and then a little introduction of him. We want to welcome you to the AMAA Pioneers and Legends Archives radio show. This is called Parts Unknown, where we feature the personal up-to-date interviews of the pioneers and legends of sport karate and the American martial art icons. I really believe that there's certain people that have created martial arts in America that need to be brought out and the people know who they are. Not just being pioneers of a sport or creating a sport, but also who they are individually and how they started. The gentleman we're doing tonight, Mr. Jeff Smith, who says we weren't glued to our television sets in 1974? Watching him fight and Mr. Lewis fight and Mr. Bill Wallace fight, and how they changed the sport after that, and people thought they'd become professionals because of what this gentleman did. Parts Unknown is the inside radio blog that is proud to do this up-close interview with a true hero of sport karate memories with world champion Jeff W. Smith. We wonder how did it all start and where he began and, who influenced him most early in his career. What was it like to be called a super brown belt? The Allen Steen years, the Master Junry years, and, of course, who was not glued to the television sets in 1974? That was the famous broadcast of the ABC Wide World of Sports, one of the largest sport networks in the country at that time. And they debuted the sport of full contact karate. Mr. Smith, he would go down in history books through the archives for the fans and for the black belts. He helped creating through Mike Anderson's vision of full contact in the 1974 Full Contact World Championships, where he earned the very first ever title with two other American icons I spoke earlier of in sport karate, Mr. Bill Wallace and Mr. Joe Lewis, rest in peace. They set the standard for the future. What was his most memorable fight? And what was their event that changed his life direction? What was it like to fight a debut match in front of millions of people, soon to be fans, with the Muhammad Ali broadcast and introducing to the world that full contact kickboxing was a real professional sport for the public? Now Mr. Smith travels the world sharing his expertise and secrets of being one of the true champions of this American-born sport. And the Sport Karate Museum Archives is very proud. I received Mr. Smith's red, white, and blue stars and stripe uniform signed and given to me personally at the Black Belt Magazine Festival. A stunning moment for the archives of sport karate. Being one of the original history generals chosen, he is mentioned to the Sport Karate Museum Archives to a higher level with his expertise and his love of the sport and truly protecting the history one warrior at a time. You know, this show will have a special Legends name game for the listeners and fans. And Mr. Smith will talk about some of his favorite people and the men he has had combat with, such as Tonya Tibbethad, Wally Slocke, Dr. Mind G, Howard the Flash Jackson, rest in peace, Jim Ronan Harrison, Pat Johnson, Jim Butte, Glenn Keeney the Fox, Fred Whirlwind Wren, Mike Stone, Jerry the Lion Man Pennington, Chuck Norris, Gentleman Joe Corley, Stephen Oliver, Bill Balls Clark, Bill Superfoot Wallace, and Mr. Joe Lewis. Rest in peace. Please welcome and enjoy this parts unknown inside story of an original world champion, Mr. Jeff W. Smith, an American hero. But I've got a surprise for you, listeners. On the line, we also have Gentleman Joe Corley, one of the original pioneers of full contact and the mentorship of the Sport Karate Museum Archives. Mr. Corley, Mr. Smith, are you guys there, please?
We are here.
Yes, wow. We are.
This is so exciting for a historian, and especially someone who's a fan, to have Mr. Smith and Mr. Corley on the line. And later on, I understand we're going to get a call from Florida, and that's Mr. Wallace, and one maybe from Colorado, that's Mr. Oliver. So we're bouncing from Texas, Atlanta, Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Colorado. That's a pretty full circle, don't you think so, Mr. Smith?
I think we have the country covered.
Yes, sir. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and you know how I feel about you personally, but, you know, to the listeners, I'd like for them to understand how you started, and I'm really proud to say you started in Texas, and kind of talk about how that started and then how you got involved with Mr. Steen and Mr. Reed. Okay, so I'd like to start off with, say, who is Jeff W. Smith, and how did you get started?
Well, you know, I owe it all to Grandmaster June Ree because, you know, he was a foreign exchange student and came to Texas in 1956 and attended the University of Texas. And then thanks to his great students of Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and many others that followed, they were able to perpetuate his training. And one of his black belts from Austin at the University of Texas happened to be from my hometown. His name was Bruce Turner. And a big black belt, 6'5", 275. So my first combat as a white belt was against, you know, a 6'5", 275-pound black belt. So you get introduced to Texas karate the rough and tumble blood and guts era right away. You know, that was back before any pads or any equipment. So we were, everything was bare knuckle. And the philosophy in Texas in fighting was if you kill the body, the head will die. And you don't get disqualified hitting to the body, only if you hit too hard to the head. But then they had the Texas rule to cover that. They say, if he ran into it, then it wasn't a penalty. And, of course, 90% of the time, the guys getting hit were coming in, so it almost gave you a free shot. But I was able to have Master Ree come down every semester at Texas A&I, as he did with a lot of the clubs that he started with his black belts from Texas. When he went to Washington, D.C., in the early 60s, Alan Steen and Pat Burleson and some of his other black belts continued on his style, and Grandmaster Ree would come down every semester and do the belt testing for all of these schools in Texas, and then these schools in Texas eventually started spreading out into other states when they graduated and going back to their hometown. So all of a sudden he had these little satellite schools all over the country that he was giving the belt test to. And I was able to, you know, be part of one of those universities in my hometown in Kingsville, Texas, at Texas A&I University, which is now called Texas A&M at Kingsville. So it's a satellite school of Texas A&M. But
that's how I started, and that's how I came about.
Wow, that's great. And, you know, I know that Master Reese started in Santa Marcos, and, you know, and Texas owes him so much. But the neat thing about, when I think about Jeff W. Smith, I wonder, because I've always wondered, when did you decide to leave Texas and to go and pursue your Washington, D.C. career that you did? When did you leave Texas?
Well, again, I have to give thanks to, you know, Grandmaster Alan Steen, too, because he was putting together, you know, he had one of the biggest tournaments, the U.S. Championships there in Dallas, Texas, and I was able to compete in that coming up in the lower belts and do quite well. And when I became a brown belt, I was lucky enough to fight for first place against my good friend, a future good friend. I didn't know him till that match and that tournament. Before that, I hadn't heard of him and didn't know who he was, but after that, I certainly did, because he beat me for first place. That was my who eventually became my teammate, Pat Worley. But thanks to Alan Steen, you know, we had a team of black belts that were, you know, that were great all over the country, but the brown belts was not something that everybody else put together, a what they call a super brown belt team or a Texas brown belt team. So he got Chuck Norris to put together a brown belt team with Mike Stone out in California, and we ended up Alan Steen ended up challenging them at the Mike Stone's All-Star Championships that he had. It was called the Four Seasons that he was doing every season out in California. And so we took our brown belt team, and that was made up of Pat Worley and myself and Fast Billy Watson. They called him back then, not Wallace, but Fast Bill Watson, who was a great dominator. Yeah, and he was dominating the brown belt division, and when he moved into black belt, he was dominating that for a long time too. And Harry Leggett and Rick Vaughn. So we were the team, and we went out there and we beat Chuck Norris's team, and it was a typical Texas knockdown, drag out fighting. And California hadn't seen that style of fighting, so they thought we had a little bit of a grudge against those guys. But then they saw afterwards how, you know, that's just the way we fight, and we were all friends afterwards. But That helped gain a lot of recognition for that group of brown belts who eventually went on to black belt, a lot of them to black belt recognition. Well,
that explains the super black belt, I mean, the super brown belt title that you guys got. You know, when you did move to Washington, D.C., it wasn't called kickboxing as it is called now. It was called full contact. And you were already hitting really hard. I mean, I followed your career from the early days. Was it easy to make that transition? I mean, was it easy for you mentally to do that?
For me, it was, because, you know, when I fought,
I mean, to be
point,
confined
was...
in a ring, you know, and get paid for it and all those things. I know that you went through a lot. I'm just curious, did you have to change anything radically, Mr. Smith?
Yeah, there was a lot of different training that had to be done, because now you're in a boxing ring, so you have confinement. Now... you can get in the corner and the guy can keep on wailing on you. They don't stop and call the point and let you catch your breath. You have to fight from bell to bell. And in that ring, there's no place to hide. But in 1970, when I was a senior at Texas A&I, Grandmaster Reed came to Texas and asked me if I would come to Washington, D.C. and teach for him. And so I was fortunate enough to have that opportunity, and that's when I moved to Washington, D.C. in 1970. And he needed some other instructors, so I brought along my good friend by then, Pat Worley, and his brother, and some other Texas guys. So we started a whole string of junior black belts from Texas, bringing them out to Washington, D.C. to introduce the East Coast to the Texas style of fighting. And then,
well, it's amazing what Mr. Worley, John and Pat, and Mr. Carnahan has done with the Diamond Nationals and just what they've created with NASCA. And that's interesting, because a lot of people don't realize that it started with Mr. Smith, by putting that team together and working and bringing these people together. Now, I'm going to take you to 1974, where it's 1970, say whatever the year was that you started talking about this idea of a ringless mat in front of ABC Wide World of Sports. I'm so interested about asking that question. So how did that start? And just tell me your journey with that.
It was a quick evolution there of Grandmaster reinventing the safety equipment. And he had this foam padding on our hands and our feet. Well, then all of a sudden the guys in the tournaments, you know, he invented that to prevent injuries. But in reality, what was happening, the guys were thinking that that was an invitation to hit hard as you can. So guys started hitting so hard that they eventually realized that they were going to have to start a new division to make a clarification that there was either light contact or there was full contact. And the full contact was going to go to a knockout. And originally it wasn't in a boxing ring. It was just an open platform. But we realized that we couldn't fight like that full contact because they kept knocking each other off the stage and falling on the chairs and the tables. So they realized that they were going to have to go to a boxing ring. So in 1974, thanks to Mike Anderson and Joe Lewis had already been doing some kickboxing matches, but not organized on a national association. And so they decided to put together the first PKA and call it Professional Karate Association World Championships. And what they did, they had four weight classes, and we had a rating system in the semi-contact already, and Joe Lewis was number one in the heavyweight, and I was number one in light heavyweight. Bill Wallace was number one in the middleweight, and Howard Jackson was number one in the lightweight. So the four of us represented the United States in that first World Championships held in Los Angeles, and which was televised on the Wide World Sports that you were talking about earlier. So
yes.
That's how that first PKA World Championships came about in 1974, and how that whole new sport evolved and eventually evolved in what is now UFC and MMA and Glory and all these other full contact kickboxing, no rules, even though there are ruled matches. And even though Mike Anderson and Joe Lewis started it, it was Joe Corley who jumped on board and took over the PKA and helped set up the whole televised system and hooked all the live shows and the televised shows and got a big contract with ESPN to do it on a weekly shows. So now all of a sudden we were on all the time thanks to Joe Corley and his efforts that he, you know, spent untiring hours of negotiating with all of the TV people to try to get these things televised all over the country. And
I've got a double shotgun here. I've got Mr. Corley on the line. So, Mr. Corley, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to ask you a question. Did you see, when you saw the vision of television and the PKA and where it could go and still have that vision, please share with my listeners how you took it to that level that you took it that Mr. Smith talked about?
Well, Jeff's really generous, you know, giving me credit for that. My objective and my mission really was to show to the television world out there what the qualities were of the Jeff Smiths of the world, not only in the ring, but as martial artists. So we had a great agent, which was IMG, and IMG negotiated the ESPN deal, the NBC deals, and all that. And my job was just to make sure that what we put together was, you know, world-class and was good quality. So that was really my function. And CBS had originally hired me to do the commentary on the Bill Wallace series of fights because they liked the way that I articulated the sport. And it was at the first one that I did where he fought Blinky Rodriguez, where I got together with the Quines. Mike Anderson had already left the PKA by then. So the Quines and I, who hadn't liked each other very much prior to that time, got together and decided that we would work together to try to build the sport on television. So we did that. you know, over the next, let's see, from 77 through 1985. So a relationship lasted about 8 years with them, and then we all split up and started to work sometime shortly after that with international syndication and then ultimately with Showtime. So we had a quite a new, quite a interesting set of venues to actually show the great skills of the fighters. And Jeff Smith, you know, he was really a participant at every one of those venues. He did commentary with us on ESPN. He fought on ESPN. He did commentary with us on the Showtime events. And he played a lot of roles.
Yes, he did, and you did too, of course. Now we're established a sport. We're on television. You're doing everything, and then there comes this fight, the famous fight with Kareem Allah. How do you pronounce it?
Kareem Allah.
Yes, the first self-proclaimed 10th degree black belt in the country, out of New York. And this was going to be a sub-fight or a co-fight. I'll let you explain to the listeners more. How did it get about? How did it start? And this is where you performed in front of millions of people, and you took the sport to a whole different level. How many rounds did you go? Nine rounds or 12?
This was the first time. Up until that point, nine rounds was the longest fight that they had. And they wanted to make it longer because boxing was 12 rounds. But the karate people thought an even number was not as good because they thought that it was more likely to end in a draw. And with an odd number of rounds, they were thinking there was less chance of that. So they ended up doing it 11 rounds. And that was the first time that anybody had gone 11 rounds. And then not too long after that, we eventually went to 12 rounds, and that's what it was for many, many years. But
yes, sir.
Don King was the promoter of that Muhammad Ali fight. And Kareem Allah was, and his name is Kareem Abdallah now, and he is from New York City. And he was, you know, well known in the New York City area. His students were dominating all of the tournaments and circuit. And he was back then a 10th degree black belt in his own system that he created, he called the KA system. And Kevin Thompson was one of his top black belts who went on to become one of the top martial artists on the national circuit in the NASCA circuit for many, many years till he came down with Lou Gehrig's disease a couple of years ago. And, you know, we still, you know, wish him well and hope that we find a cure to get him out of that. But Don King promotes this fight with Muhammad Ali, so Kareem Allah being in New York City and knowing the same people because he knew Muhammad Ali, they decided they were going to do a first time ever a world champion kickboxing with a world champion boxing. Well, Kareem was a heavyweight and I was a light heavyweight, but he was supposed to fight Joe Lewis, so it was supposed to be a heavyweight fight. Then Joe Lewis got hurt fighting Ross Scott 6 weeks to 8 weeks before the fight and dislocated his shoulder and wasn't able to continue to be able to train and fight and get ready for it. So Joe Lewis suggested to them that they should put me up because I'm, you know, the most well-known in the rest of the people that could fight him. And, you know, in boxing, they've done that before where they had a heavyweight champion versus a light heavyweight champion type thing. So I was actually fighting him for the heavyweight title. And as it played out, it went to the 11 rounds, and I won a decision. And 50 million people watched that live, so it gave us a great jump start and a great introduction to the world because – on closed circuit, everything was live because it went worldwide. You know, a lot of times our pay-per-view events now that we have are just the U.S., and it's harder to get them all hooked up all over the world. So with the closed circuit, 50 million people, and I think that it still holds the record for the largest viewing audience of a live martial arts event. So that was 1975.
Who was your coach for that fight? Who coached you for that fight besides Mr. Ree?
Well,
you got your boxing
you,
and all that. Your
the man that you have on the phone with us right now had a lot to do with my training, Joe Corley, because I would go down to Atlanta and train with him at his schools with his black belts, Jerry Rome, and he had a whole slew of black belts that were some of the best in the country. You know, I had my guys that I would train here, but the advantage that I had down there is Joe Corley had been introduced to one of the top Olympic and professional boxing coaches, Asa Gordon, and said that I needed to come down there and get in the boxing gym and train with them. So that's what I did. And so my boxing background is all because of the way Joe introduced it to me and got me to come down there and go to the boxing gyms. And then we took our lickings because they wouldn't let us kick them, so we had to play their game and box with them. And, of course, having never boxed like that before, we're fighting amateur Golden Gloves boxers that have had 50 or 60 fights. So it was quite the
experience. I got to ask Mr. Corley, were you excited about being able to put the – when did you fight Mr. Wallace? What year did you fight Mr. – before this fight? Before this fight,
yeah,
right?
It was. It was earlier in the year. It was about 5 months before the fight with
cool. So
with
my question is, were you excited about being able to see full contact being introduced to the boxing world? I mean, that had to excite you, right?
Yeah. It was. It was a great opportunity, and I think fate played a big role in having Joe Lewis get hurt and Jeff Smith being able to fill in and take his place. And you know, I think it was it's just the way it was meant to be.
Yes, sir. Now, when you fought him, Mr. Smith, what was he hitting you with, or did he hit you at all? I mean, I don't remember watching the fight.
Is on YouTube, so anybody wants to see it. And I think we put it in several parts because I got it that way in parts. So if anybody just goes to YouTube and puts World Champion Jeff Smith, it'll come up with a list of fights, and that Kareem Abdallah is one of those fights on there. Yeah.
Well, I've got a hardcore guy that wanted me to ask you a question because he followed all your fights, and he said one of your favorite techniques, and I remember seeing this at the Keith Havlicek fight, you'd use the ring, bounce off, and throw a rich hand. That was purposely done, right? Because you knocked a lot of people out with that ridge hand.
Again, my ridge hand was my pre-boxing days because, in karate, you didn't do a lot of inside fighting. Most of it was from the outside. So you had your long reverse punches or you had your back fist that was extended. And then we had our ridge hands that I actually learned that ridge hand from Mike Stone. I watched him use it, and I saw what he did to Chuck Norris and some other guys, and I said, and then I saw Fred Wren using it, and so now, you know, I knew I had to use it. And then the funny thing about it is, the first time I fought Fred Wren, I beat him using his ridge hands. And that was the only way I could. He was just so aggressive. But those ridge hands turned into hooks later on because of our more inside fighting. And but in first world championship, the first guy I fought was from Yugoslavia, and I knocked him out in 30 seconds with that front ridge hand, not the rear hand, but the front ridge hand. And he laid out there for about 3 minutes, 4 minutes, trying to wake him up. So it worked.
Wow. Well, we've taken our listeners up through your Kareem fight, and I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to plug a couple sponsors here real quick, do a couple things, and I'll come back. We're going to play the Legends Name Game with you and Mr. Corley. Can you stay on the line just for a couple minutes, please?
No problem.
Okay, sir, I'll be right back. We'd like to take a moment to welcome our sponsors and our new sponsors to the radio blog. Of course, Dr. Nick Chamberlain and the Gathering of Eagles. They'll be in Dallas August 11th, 12th, and 13th. This will also be the Kimpo International Black Belt Hall of Fame. We're also being powered by Juventix. Juventix is the new event registration format that is going to be powered at Euphoria this year, April the 22nd. Always, Century Fitness, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, they're the sponsors for the who's who in the martial arts graphic book. I'd like to also say that we'd like to thank our friends at Black Belt Magazine, Mr. Floyd Burke, and Mr. Robert Young, the senior editor, who's always been supportive through the years. Again, thank you for the emails. Tonight, we're not going to go through emails because we got such a special line of guests. But I do want to mention that the people will be coming up. Next week, we'll have Mr. Arnold Zip White, national competitor for many years on the circuit. Mr. Roy Kerbin, the inventor of the three-point kick. April 24th will be Bernie Pops Kranz Sue. Mr. Kerbin will be April 18th, and Mr. Zip will be April the 8th. Upcoming in May will be Mr. Dan Anderson, Mr. Bob Liker, Mr. Jim Buten, and Mr. Bill Viola. We also like to say a big congratulations to Mr. Glenn Keeney, who this weekend at the Bill Wallace event received the Superfoot Award, the highest award giving out at the Superfoot tournament. We also like to say thank you again for all the support that everyone came out and came to the Bill Wallace event. Thank you so much. We had a great book signing for the Who's Who in Martial Arts with Jesse Bowen. I believe we got rid of all the books. Also coming up at the MGM Super Show in Las Vegas, the Pioneers and Legends booth will be featuring Haunchy Jesse Bowen with his live radio show, Legends and Pioneers. We'll have legend Jim Buten with his book and world champion Jimmy Tabaris, July 6th to the 8th. And also representation from the Sport Karate Museum Archives, Mr. Jim Butcher. We also like to say that August 4th and 5th, Mr. Dennis Brown, a NASCAR event, the U.S. Capital Classic, will host a Legends Banquet and the book signing for the Legends Banquet that will be held in Washington, D.C. Remember, we really appreciate your time and listening to our show. Well, we're coming back to part two, and this is my favorite part of my interview. Normally we do 4 or 5, but tonight, because Mr. Smith has touched so many people, and so has Mr. Corley, so I like his 2 cents too. We're going to handpick a list of people that have touched Mr. Smith's lives, or Mr. Smith has touched their lives, or they're very special. And this is where the parts unknown comes into mind. So you gentlemen, are you ready?
Yeah. And Gary, since you were doing commercials at that time, I'll just get my little commercial in there. You know, I have a seminar coming up on Thursday, April the 6th. I'm doing my Extreme Success Academy national tour, and I'm going to be in Rockville, Maryland. And then on Monday, April 10th, I'm going to be in New York City. And if you need more information, you can call Bob Dunn at 720-256-0208 or go to www.extremesuccessacademy.com. And Stephen Oliver and I will be doing those all over the country. We're going to be in Atlanta after New York, and then Boston, San Antonio, Cleveland, L.A., Denver, Seattle, Tampa, Toronto, just in the next few months. So when I say I'm going to be everywhere, I mean it.
You are. Well, that's great. And anybody's a Jeff Smith fan or a Stephen Oliver follower or the business aspects that he passes on, please go to the cities and see the seminar. Great times with the Grail champion. Here we go, guys. I'm going to throw some names at you.
Okay.
Here we go. Ready? First one, John Natividad.
You know, John Natividad was one of the Chuck Norris guys that I seemed to always be fighting in the finals everywhere I went, whether I went to Mike Stone's All-Star Championship Four Seasons tournament or the Internationals or even tournaments on the East Coast or Atlanta. You know, it's wherever I went, he was always there. So he was always such a gentleman, but such a great, one of the real early Chuck Norris black belts that was, you know, really carrying on that Chuck Norris kicking tradition. So, you know, between him and Darnell Garcia, you know, John Natividad won the Internationals in 70. Let's see, I won it in 74. He won it in 72. And then Darnell won it in 73. And then I fought both Darnell and John Natividad at Ed Parker's Internationals in 1974. And that was just before the first World Championships. And it was actually my last point style or, you know, that style of fighting. And it still holds a special place because I really wanted to win that one because most of the people that won that was you know, 10 years before that is when Alan Steen won it, and Alan Steen and I were the only two people outside of California to win it. So that's the grand championship in fighting, not the forms and the other stuff. So I was really looking forward to trying to take that victory back to Texas to keep Grandmaster Alan Steen tradition.
Yes, sir. Well, John, too, that was one of my Hawaiian heroes, without a doubt. Next name, Wally Slocke.
And Wally was really before his time. I mean, he was the Canadian badass. I mean, he was afraid of nobody. He fought a full contact match with Joe Louis. He fought a full contact match with Bill Wallace, and he fought me in the first World Championships, and I beat him on a close decision. And so I felt I needed to avenge that. So my first title defense, thanks to Joe Corley, he put on that rematch for defending my title in a nine-round fight at the Battle of Atlanta. And on that one, I won a unanimous decision, and it was it kind of cleared up that question back then. But before that first World Championships, he really was the dominant Canadian fighter. And a lot of people didn't know that he was the Bill Wallace kicker before Bill Wallace. He actually could kick and hold his legs straight up in the air like Bill does now when Bill couldn't do it. And Bill actually had picked that up. And this is, we'll have Bill clarify this, but he saw Wally do that, and that frustrated him that he couldn't do it. And that gave him the incentive to go, and then he got to where he even surpassed Wally's kicking with that fabulous left leg of his.
Absolutely. Well, this next gentleman is actually my Garrett, my son's godfather, Dr. Manji.
You know, Dr. G holds a special place for me because he's such a pioneer in the Bondo system and bringing kickboxing to America. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be invited by him to teach at his camps, his summer camps, and all of his black belts were just such good guys and such tough fighters. We would have them come over and we would do fights, you know, train with our DC crew, you know, Mike Coles and Rodney Batiste and Dan Magnus and Danny Bicagno. You know, those were my main full contact guys, kickboxing guys. And so we'd have the Bondo guys come over, and they would fight with us all the time. Bob Maxwell would bring his guys over, and Harvey Hastings, you know, was another one of those tough pioneer kickboxers who fought one of the first kickboxing matches. And he actually did a kickboxing exhibition when I won that U.S. Pro-Am put on by Bob Maxwell in Ocean City, Maryland, and I won that Grand Championship in 73 and 74. And that was an important tournament because it was the first time they had given money. So they actually gave us money, and they gave us $500, and, you know, we
wow.
felt like it was a jackpot. You know, we were holding up the money, and you know, like, because before we never got anything but a trophy, so at least we got a trophy. And Dr. Manji was the center referee for those fights, so he also was the center referee in a lot of my other fights, and he was a center referee in the Kareem fight and in a lot of other fights. And there were some good center judges that Joe Corley had selected to run those PKA matches, along with JT Will, which was a great point fighter and martial artist from Ohio, one of those Tracy black belts, and trained with Joe Louis and on the Joe Louis team. And Bill Clark, who was also one of the top point fighters and also a kickboxer and one of the top-ranked fighters in the country in kickboxing. And Joe recruited him to do the kickboxing matches for the center referee for the PKA. So we needed good judges like that, and those were the guys that did most of my fights. Probably between those three, they probably did every fight that I ever fought in. So
wow.
They were
okay.
You know,
How about, we've lost him a few years back, but you asked me to mention him, Mr. Howard the Flash Jackson.
You know, he was really the fastest fighter that I had ever fought and probably ever did fight in any of my matches. And anybody who fought him, just that's why they called him the Flash. I mean, he kind of reminded me of the Flash, where you'd see him here and then you'd see him there. So when you're fighting him, you'd see him here, and then the next thing you know, he's right in your face punching you. So he was amazing, and he did represent the U.S. in that first World Championships, but he had a knee injury in a point tournament in Denver about a couple months before that, where he slipped on a paper cup in a match.
Yes, sir.
And tore his knee and couldn't use it hardly at all, or we could have dominated and had all four. And he went on to have an illustrious kickboxing career and won the WKA
yes.
World Championship after that, and was just really one of my closest competitors that I always hung out with at all the events, and, you know, passed away a few years back.
You've been to a couple of my roasts. I mean, we roasted Dick Campbell. Don Wilson stood up in front of the crowd, about 400 people, and he asked for the microphone, and he said, "I'd like to acknowledge the greatest striker in the room tonight, and that's Howard Jackson." And he got a standing ovation, and God bless him. The next man, who was one of the PKA early referees, too, who we're honoring this year at Living Legends, he's 80 years old, Mr. Jim Ronan Harrison.
Well, Jim Harrison he's like the hitman.
That's how you smile. Yeah, I can see
everybody. Nobody wanted to fight him. If there was a line to get for the tournament lining up, everybody would move away from him. Nobody wanted to fight him, because whether you won or lost, and he didn't lose very often, you look like you've been in a dogfight. You are torn up. You got stitches. So it wasn't a matter. You could usually count the winner on who had the less stitches. And, I saw him fighting in a point tournament in Texas, where they were stopping him in the middle of the fight and sewing him up and putting him back in there to fight again. That was my introduction when I was a brown belt, watching him and Fred Wren fight. And knowing that I was going to get to in very soon how excited I was to be able to look at them and know that I was going to have to fight them in less than a year.
you're talking about that fight there. That was a fight against Victor Moore, and it was J. Pat Burleson, I understand, that stapled the cut shut. So, yeah, that's pretty strange back then. Mr. Pat Johnson. Pat Johnson.
And he holds a special place in both Joe Corley and my heart, because he's such a gentleman. And he was really, along with Pat Burleson, two of the first guys to really promote the business of the martial arts. And the thing about Pat Johnson is he would also introduce the penalty point system and the non-contact stuff. And so he has a lot to do with sport karate all over the country. And he was the anchor of the Chuck Norris team. And as a matter of fact, he still holds this against me jokingly. He had 300 matches in team fighting and never lost in 300 matches. And his last match before he retired was against me. Of course, that was in Washington, D.C., so maybe the judges were a little prejudiced. But I was able to pull out a close victory there, but kind of spoiled his perfect record that he wanted to retire with. So he says that he has 300 wins and then one theft.
Well, okay, Mr. Smith, I want to get everybody you asked me to, so we need to cut just a little short, please. Here we go. Okay. Mr. Jim Buten.
Jim Buten was, one of those anchor Texas fighters, was always in the finals. My first black belt tournament, he was in the finals. I had the fortune of, or should I say misfortune of fighting Ed Daniels in my first black belt tournament in the finals. And luckily I got disqualified hitting him with a jump reverse sidekick in the nose and broke his nose and knocked him down. And so he had his help from Pat Burleson, comes over and they stuffed cotton up his nose after they reset it with two pencils and then taped it up. And then he goes, "Good kick, Jeff." And Texas rule, they didn't even disqualify me. They just gave me a penalty point, but it was enough to lose the match. And then he ended up fighting Jim Buten for first place. And
Jim was also on our U.S. Team with Joe Louis and Bill Wallace and Howard Jackson when we fought all over Europe and won the European World Championships over there. I fought him in point tournaments, and I had beaten him, but he had beaten me too. And the last tournament that I fought him in just before the World Championships in kickboxing was top 10 nationals. So I wanted to avenge that. So I gave him the opportunity at my second title defense. I fought him in Washington, D.C. And I kind of paid him back at that event. That was the rules, and they were still experimenting with rules. We didn't even have ropes yet. And the rule back then, and Joe will remember this, if you knocked your opponent down, it ended the round because they wanted to make sure he got his head clear so he didn't get hurt. They were afraid somebody was going to get killed. So I knocked him down every round for the first five rounds, and then the fifth round he finally didn't get back up. So they gave me the victory. But that was some of those weird rules they were doing back then. But that fight was a nine-round fight, also scheduled, but ended in five.
How about Glenn Keeney, the Fox?
You know, Glenn was one of those guys. The first time I saw him fight, you know, I was going, this is who Bill Wallace had trained with a lot and fought with and picked up a lot of his sly techniques. And you would watch him and you would think, oh, this guy's not going to be hard to beat. He doesn't look that fast, and he doesn't throw that many flashy techniques until you have to face him. And then all of a sudden, you go to throw a kick, and then all of a sudden he's inside with his timing. He just had such perfect timing that he knocked off so many top fighters, and he was one of the top-ranked, always in the top 10 back in those days.
Fred Whirlwind Wren.
You know, Fred was probably... You know, back then when I got my black belt in 1969, he was probably right near the top of his game or on top of his game and was really, you know, dominating everybody. And the thing was, he was in the cut from the same cloth as a Jim Harrison. You know, he just was relentless and would never let up. He would just keep striking and hitting and kicking and punching even after they called breaks. So it was another one of those, you know, you were going to be in a dogfight. And I was lucky enough to come out on top with him on several of occasions and get out of there with my life. Even though on one of the occasions, the only way I could beat him was with that ridge hand, but I have the pins in my thumb to prove it.
Yes, sir. Mike Stone.
Mike Stone was... you know, before, and again, he was in that pre-70 years. He was the 60s and pretty much dominating everything. And, you know, one of the first guys, what he had in tenacity and aggressiveness, his technique was, you know, he wasn't the flashiest looking technique. You know, Chuck Norris probably had the best technique, and Skipper Mullins, those guys had the best technique, and David Moon. These were the technicians back then, and Mike Stone was one of those that, you know, I think that Fred Wren picked up his fighting style from. You know, Fred was kind of a combination of Mike Stone and Jim Harrison, and neither Mike Stone or Jim Harrison did you want to fight because you know that you were going to have something to show. You were going to have a cut or a scar or something to remember them by. They never let anybody off easy.
Yes, sir. Jerry, the Lion Man Pennington.
You know, Pennington was one of the first, what I call martial artists who, you know, he kind of reminded me of, you know, he had his uniform on his back and he traveled all over the country and fought everywhere. And, you know, he was a true martial artist and, you know, he had his long hair and his mustache and beard and very intimidating. You know, he was on the high side of 200 and had power that when you fought him, it was very intimidating. And the first time I fought him up here in the D.C. area, I was lucky enough to squeak out a close victory. But it wasn't by overpowering him. It was more by surviving the match.
Mr. Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris was the you know, gentleman Joe Corley. Well, Chuck Norris was kind of like the gentleman Chuck Norris, the nicest guy outside of the ring. But when he was in the ring, it was all business. And everything he did, he didn't have a lot of wasted technique. It was very clean. You know, he's landing side kicks, clean reverse punches. And, you know, he brought this whole team of black belts from almost single-handedly. This whole Chuck Norris system was responsible for developing, you know, probably 25% of all the top national fighters back then. They were just dominating wherever they went just because they were copying his technique and using everything that he did that he shared with them. And
well,
course,
I want to ask you about Mr. Norris and Mr. Corley. Was he that good, Mr. Smith? Was he really that good, what people have built him up to be? Was he really that good?
Well, I will tell you this. He was good enough to beat everybody on the planet back then.
Yes.
So how good did you have to be? Well, how much
really?
Better than can you be than beating everybody? Now,
everybody. So it wasn't all hype. Wasn't all movies. Yeah.
You go back and you watch him, and you'll say, well, in today's standard of technique, I'm sure there's a lot of people that could beat him today, but not back then. You know, it's kind of like football and the other sports. If you kind of go back to where those best people were back then, most of the sports have evolved and the technique has got better because they stood on his shoulders. In other words, they learned from him to take it to another level. So everybody kept taking it to a higher level. So I never underplay the people that came at the beginning because they're the ones that set the foundation, the Alan Steens and Pat Burlesons and Mike Stone and Ron Martini and guys like that.
Yes, sir. I had heard through my research that he was one of the first guys to do a spin back kick. Do you hear that before? Or nobody was really doing a spin kick?
I just know that nobody scored more with it than him back then.
Okay, good answer.
Probably one of the best kickers back then was probably Skipper Mullins. Nobody had flashier kicks than him back then.
Yes.
And, you know, he wasn't a big fighter. I mean, he was probably 150, 160 pounds at best at his heaviest weight back then. But he was fighting all of these guys, Fred Wren, Jim Harrison, and, you know, holding his own and beating guys like this on a regular basis. So he was another one of those guys that had a fabulous technique, along with David Moon, who's now in Mexico City. You know, he's one of the only Koreans back then that actually competed. Him and Byung Yu and a few of the other Koreans actually put it on the line and went to our tournaments, not the traditional tournaments, and actually fought our rules and were some of the top in the country.
Amazing business entrepreneur and businessman from Mile High Karate, Stephen Oliver.
You know, Steve and I are very close now, and we're doing a lot of business things together, the Extreme Success Academy, and he has a consulting group, our mastery group, that he's training martial arts schools all over the country. But he's one of the marketing geniuses and one of the best things that happened to the martial arts, because as he came up as a very, you know, excited student as a black belt and came up from Washington, D.C., from Oklahoma to train at the June Reese School. And he was from one of our satellite schools back in Oklahoma. And he came up to Washington, D.C. and tested for his black belt and then ended up going to Georgetown University and getting his degree in business and learning the martial arts from the ground up. He was fighting with all of our world-class kickboxers. And then he decided we weren't making enough money for him. He had a higher vision. You know, he said, I'm going to take this sport to another level on business side. He was winning the tournaments and point stuff, but, you know, he realized those were just trophies. So when he moved out to Denver to open his schools, in 6 months, he had five schools and started from there and now started a dynasty in the martial arts school development business.
Well, this next gentleman, he I met him in the early 70s, and Larry Reinhart introduced me to him. Bill Balls Clark.
Another one of Joe and I's good friends, and a real
good guy.
Another one of those well-rounded guys. He's one of the top ATA guys, and you know, thanks to him, the ATA has developed the way it has, to one of the largest organizations in the country, because of his all the different hats. You know, not only was he a top competitor and officiating at the tournaments, you know, with the center ref and the PKA, and he was a full contact fighter and he was a top point fighter, but then he ran his schools and expanded them, and it, you know, now has 50 schools, and he has black belts that he's developed that have 50 schools. So that's not even counting the ATA with all of their schools. They have even a lot more than that. So he's just you know, a master of several dimensions. So I have a lot of respect for him.
Yes, sir. And I'm going to put you on the spot because he's on the line. Gentleman Joe Corley.
And Joe is another one of those pioneers. When I first met him in New York City, we hit it off right away. And it only took one ride in my van with all of our D.C. team to make him a fellow D.C. Black belt. You know, he had our style with his Taekwondo Korean background, with his jump kicks, and I liked his fighting style, and he wasn't afraid of anybody and would fight anybody, and was at the head of the development of kickboxing, and one of the first ones to, I mean, who else is looking to fight Bill Wallace? You know, he's not just wanting to fight in the middleweight division. He wants to go against Bill Wallace and take him all the way down to the end and almost finished it. And Bill landed what Joe now refers to as one of his lucky techniques that they stopped the fight too short, that he was still ready to continue and maybe could have come back and won.
But he's laughing in the background. I can hear him. Grandmaster Jun Rhee.
You know, Grandmaster Rhee is like the ultimate pioneer and the ultimate grandmaster. You know, he's the grandmaster's grandmaster. You know, nobody had a better vision than him for the development of martial arts. You know, he's the one that planted this seed years ago for us, that martial arts would be as big as professional sports, as football and basketball. And now, even with UFC and the numbers that they're doing and things, it has become one of the top spectator sports in the country. And he told us this years ago, and his vision of the safety equipment, his introducing martial arts, what he called martial arts ballet, which was classical music with martial arts. He was one of the first ones to do that in competition. His city versus city things that he did, his teaching the congressional, the congressmen and the senators on Capitol Hill for over 30 years, his introducing martial arts to Russia and revolutionizing that whole business side of the school system, not just teaching martial arts, but making it a business and keeping the quality of the students and the black belt tradition. He's just really the pioneer and grandmaster. And I owe everything that I've done, you know, I would still be back in Texas probably doing, you know, working at the local something, had it not been for him inviting me and having me come out to Washington, D.C., and then teach me this whole business from the ground up and inspiring me to become a world champion and to keep training and competing and things like that. So I owe
yes,
him
sir.
A lot.
Well, happy-go-lucky, hamburger-eating, ice-cream-loving Bill Superfoot Wallace.
Well, there's probably not another guy on the planet that is loved by more people. I have to say, he has to be the most popular, and he's always been like that because he's always so upbeat. No matter what's going on, he's never has a bad day. He's always upbeat and laughing and just joking around with everybody lightheartedly until you get in the ring with him, and then you got to watch out because he's so damn fast. That left leg and that left hand of his is so fast. You know, not only did he dominate in the point fighting, you know, everybody thought when he went into kickboxing, because he was following the rules in point, and he wasn't ever, he never hurt anybody in point fighting. Whereas a lot, Jim Harrison, Fred Wren, Mike Stone, these guys all punished people in point fighting. But so they thought that
yes,
he
sir.
Wouldn't last when he got into the full contact of kickboxing. And he proved them all wrong, because all he did was change his style of training. And now he started hitting people harder. So it wasn't he couldn't hit them harder. He was just too nice and didn't want to hit them any harder because he didn't have to get a point. And so he goes into kickboxing and ends up being the only really undefeated, what I call the official undefeated kickboxing champion of all time. And, you know, one of my best friends and a guy that I enjoy doing a lot of, spending a lot of time with at, down in Florida and other places when he's at the tournaments and Hall of Fame things that I'm at. So I'm just lucky to call him friend and had the opportunity to compete with him over the years.
Just an incredible hero. I saved the last one because I know he's very personal to you, and I really appreciate, well, I've got both of you guys on the line. Appreciate Mr. Cordy and allowing me to use his video when you did Battle of Atlanta and allowed me to use it to Legends. And thank you, Mr. Smith, for some kind words you said about your friend. And it tested everybody in the room that night at the Legends. But I'd like you to talk about your friend Joe Lewis.
Well, there'll never be another Joe Lewis. I mean, he kind of wrote the record books, you know. There might have been fighters that had better technique than him that people argue, but as far as causing intimidation and fear into people, you know, Fred Wren and Jim Harrison and Ed Daniels and Mike Stone, these guys put fear in people's hearts. But the thing about Joe Lewis is he just looks so damn intimidating. When you would see him, you know, he was just so damn strong, and he was so conditioned. You know, he trained night and day. And as Walter Anderson, who was one of his Marine Corps buddies back in Okinawa, used to tell me, is they just trained every day. And when he came back, he just kept that same training going. And really, the real pioneer to start off kickboxing in America, had it not been for him, I don't think all of this would have evolved. He had such good concepts, and I was fortunate enough to befriend him in the early 70s and have him share a lot of his knowledge with me when we went to Europe and were on the U.S. team together. And then he stayed with me for a couple of months at a time, and I would go to California and stay with him and train. You know, he's just, you know, a real pioneer in the sport. And, you know, he'll go down as and a lot of people all voted him the number one fighter of all time. Well, there's guys that had beaten him, but if you look back when he was on top, there wasn't, you know, he stood above everybody else back then. You know, Bill
yes,
Wallace
sir.
Evolved, you know, to be the greatest middleweight of all time. And a lot of people say probably technique-wise the greatest, you know, technician of all time, just because he was just so much more advanced with his techniques than everybody else. You know, the way he could throw that left leg in any direction with a hook kick, a round kick, a side kick, and you never know which one's coming. And you, just when you would think you're going to block it, he's going to hit you with the other one. It's hard to compare anybody against his technique to say that there was anybody ever better with that, you know, with his technique. So Joe Lewis, though, is very close to Bill and I both, of course, being in the first world championship. And we were fortunate enough to be able to spend time with him quite a bit of time before he passed, and were able to go to Europe with him and do a seminar tour where the three of us were able to go and do it together and introduce him to a lot of people that didn't get to meet him before that. You know, we did the Karate College the first time Jerry Beasley put that together. We were, me, Bill, and Joe were the first three to do that with Jerry and have that Karate College and get that education in those
yes,
times of years with him. It was quite, you know, something that, you know, you just have to count your lucky stars that, you know, you couldn't have planned it out any better to have somebody like him and Bill Wallace around to show you and help you with your training and your techniques and encourage you and the encouragement they gave me over the years.
I appreciate you sharing that with my listeners and sharing with me and the Sport Karate Museum History Generals. They're listening tonight. It's very special. But out of respect, I've got to ask Mr. Corley. I know you're very close to him, too. And, you know, we are very honored, you and I. I know you give out the Internal Warrior Award, and I give out the Joe Louis Dragon Image Fighting Award to honor him every year. Mr. Corley, how did you feel about Mr. Louis and your concept of what he did?
Well, you know, everything Jeff said was just spot on. And the thing about Joe Louis, that in his era, he could not be intimidated, and he intimidated everybody that got in the ring with him. And it was we used to say that charisma was a combination of just super talent and super crazy. And Louis definitely had both those things. People that are charismatic have this a little bit of insanity about them, and everybody that knew Joe Louis knew he was at least partially insane, and it came through in his fighting.
In a good way.
Yeah. In the video we put together, we called it endearing crazy, a little bit of endearing crazy. So, but he basically set the standard for everything, for the way we fight to the fact that we even had any fighting going on. And, you know, it was all his idea, and he got Mike Anderson to help him execute it that first time. And he was the very first champion of the Battle of Atlanta. And, you know, he touched us in so many different ways. You can't even count them.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for sharing that. You know, both of you gentlemen were one of the original history generals for the Sport Karate Museum Archives. And one of the last questions I'd like to ask you is, you know, to protect the history, how important is that to record what we did and to be able to have something like artifacts like what I've done for 19 years? I'm just, you know, I know that you guys played a big part from the very beginning, and you still do every day. But don't you, it's important to keep that history in their faces, in the public's eyes, I think. Don't you believe?
And it was, you know, I mean, and thanks to you, because you've been working at this and unselfishly. I mean, you weren't doing it for the money, because obviously you were probably spending more than you were, you know, you weren't even breaking anywhere close to breaking even, even till this day. But it was just your love for the sport and your connection with so many people, and you being around to be able to get all of that information and organize it and put it into a system and a way for everybody to share, to expand that knowledge. Otherwise it could have been lost and people would have never known about that kind of history. So it's very crucial and critical for all of the sports. I mean, you know, football and all the others have their Hall of Fames and their, you know, places where people can go and find out about the early years of their sport. And without your thing, we wouldn't have that.
Well, I was inspired by Joe Corley. Joe Corley has been my mentor for many years, and especially the past 15 years. You too. But Mr. Corley, he really set the standard for becoming a historian. And I had to say that, Mr. Corley. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, let me add that the Who's Who book that Jeff and I got so inspired to help Grandmaster Bowen with last year was a way to really take those ideas and concepts that you had and then put them into a written form where we could talk about standing on the shoulders of American greatness. And then as fate would have it, it was good that you and Grandmaster Bowen got together so you could work together on this broadcast. So I think
he's such an inspiration to me. He really is.
It's all meant to be. You know, we're out here, if you look at all of it from 30,000 feet and you see all the pieces of the puzzle go together, you'll know that all this was meant to be. And we don't know where it's all going to lead yet, but in a perfect world, it'll lead to where it's supposed to lead.
Yes, sir. Well, for people who would like to know more about what we do, you can go to sportkaratemuseum.org, or you can call me at 713-483-0476, or send me an email. I really appreciate all the emails. ProfessorGaryLee@gmail.com. Wow, Master Smith, this has been so enjoyable. Mr. Corley, I just don't know what to say. I'm really lost with words just to know that I got to talk to you guys and you got to share the history. And with that said, if Mr. Bowen's on the line, if anybody else is on the line, we'd like to talk.
Hello. Hello, everyone. This was a great show. I'm so glad to be a part of it. And as I've been talking to my martial arts students all week long about the importance of knowledge, of knowing your history, this is just another proving point of so many things that's happened in the past that's so important for us to have a great appreciation for where we are today. So, guys, it was a, you know, awesome show. And we do have a lot of people in the line, and I'm going to open the lines up, and if anyone would like to make a comment or to speak to Mr. Corley, Mr. Smith, or Professor Gary Lee, the lines are now being officially open. And
I would like to talk to
somebody. Hello? Yes, it's Ryan. How are you?
Are you Ryan? This is Bill Wallace.
Hi, Mr. Wallace.
First of all, thank you
for taking my call tonight, guys.
We were talking about you, Mr. Wallace.
I heard you guys. You guys are way, way, way too nice. I got to talk to you guys about that.
Not as nice as you.
Well, hey, you know, it's awful late where you guys are. It's probably a quarter till 11. I don't know, you guys being old like me, you know, you got to get your rest.
Well, I appreciate you calling in. I've called you, and you're calling in. That's so sweet of you. All those things that Mr. Smith said about you is true. You are a sweetheart. Thanks.
Well, I don't know about that, but you got the best in the world talking to you right now, my friend, so... Joe Corley and Jeff Smith are the best there probably ever will be. Hello?
Yes, how
Thank
are
you,
hello?
Bill? Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
And we'll get on those motorcycles soon. We'll go down to the Keys soon.
We're going to go down to the Keys pretty soon. The car is ready, my friend.
We'll put the top down or hit the bikes, one or the other.
Either or. Depends on the weather.
If we have the top down, we can probably even get Joe to come with us. But if we're on the motorcycles, I don't think Joe can talk him into coming.
We can put him in the trunk. He'll be in the trunk, or he'll sit in the middle. That's what he can do. He can straddle the center console.
Okay, that'll do it.
I think Bill might be off right now, but we had a great weekend in Cleveland last weekend. We had so many things going on. Don and Rick, they did a great job. There were so many awesome things that happened last weekend with the event in Cleveland. I think that was really good. And we have a lot of things that's coming up this year that are going to be really phenomenal in the martial arts with the upcoming of the new book, the Europa Games coming up. We have a great opportunity to expand the martial arts through the Europa game. Again, special thanks to Professor Gary Lee and to Bill Viola for giving me the chance to be able to run that event in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're really hoping that this will be a kickoff of a great series of opportunities for martial arts. And the Europa Games will be in Charlotte, will be in Dallas, Phoenix, and I think that's Tampa is going to be in. So we got a lot of really good things going on, you know, in the martial arts. So I guess it's up to you, sir, Mr. Gary Lee, Professor Gary Lee.
Well,
I'd
like to say, Mr. Smith, to say something at the end of the show, but I'd like you for the end of the show, Mr. Smith, by saying, you know, how'd you do and how you feel about this interview? You happy?
I'll be traveling around the country, so I'm looking forward to seeing everybody. And if you're in any of those towns that I mentioned, again, I'll be in Rockville, Maryland, right outside of D.C.
Say one more time. Say the cities one more time. Say the cities one more time you're going to be at.
I'll be in Rockville, Maryland, right outside of D.C. in Baltimore on Thursday, April 6th. And then I'll be in New York City on Monday. That's April 10th. And then I go from there to Atlanta, Boston, San Antonio, Cleveland, L.A., Denver, Seattle, Tampa, Toronto, and all of those in just the next couple months. So give Bob Dunn a call at 720-256-0208, and he can give you more information. Or just go to www.extremesuccessacademy.com, and they'll give you all the information to give you the dates and the times. Looking forward to seeing everybody. Thanks,
you too.
Jerry.
And Mr.
Thanks,
Corey, any last words, sir? Mr. Corey, any last words you'd like to say?
No, sir. I think it was an enjoyable evening. Great work there, Mr. Lee, and Grandmaster Smith.
Thank you.
Great work for you as well, sir, and glad I could be with you guys.
Thank you, Joe.
God bless you, Mr. Corey. God bless you, Mr. Smith. You guys have a good night, and don't forget next week will be
Jerry.
Arnold Zip White. Yes, sir. Good night,
okay.
Sir. Aloha, everyone. Okay. Good night.
See you guys.
Coming to Charlotte, North Carolina, the 2017 Europa Games Sport Karate Championship, your road to the UFC International Fight Week in Las Vegas. Come check out the largest health, fitness, and sports trade show in the world, taking place in Charlotte, North Carolina. The 2017 Europa Games Get Fit Sports Fest. The event will be held on April the 22nd and 23rd, 2017. Bring your entire family. It's open to the public. Over 500,000 square feet of expo activities. Over 100 vendors sampling and selling active wear, vitamins, health food, sports equipment, anti-aging products, and much more. You'll have live sporting events, wrestling, karate, powerlifting, bodybuilding, grappling, just to name a few. We even have a kids zone with free prizes for the little ones. We'll also have Black Belt Grand Champion Forms and Fighting cash prize. Plus the AMAA Grand Champion will represent the AMAA Sport Karate League at the Battle of Atlanta in Atlanta, Georgia with a free entry. For more information, call area code 919-489-6100. Jesse Bowen.
If you own a small business, it's not a question of if some hacker is going to attempt to attack your company. It's a question of when. Let cyberpolicy.com keep you safe. Cyberpolicy is the first end-to-end solution that combines cyber planning, security, and insurance. With cyberpolicy, your business will be protected against cyber attacks for as little as 40 cents a day. Visit cyberpolicy.com today and get a quote in just 4 minutes. Cyberpolicy.com.
George's Bank scallops are now at Bonefish Grill. The George's Bank off the coast of New England is known for its amazing sea scallops, and Bonefish prepares them just right. Grilled to perfection over a wood fire and served atop creamy Parmesan risotto. And start the night off with our new handcrafted happy hour every day from 4 to 6:30. Enjoy signature cocktails like our tropical tiki martini for just $5, and new bar bites like ahi tuna poke are just $6. So come in tonight and discover what's new at Bonefish Grill.